"What's it concerning?" I asked. There was a pause, like she wasn't really supposed to let that sort of information out, and then she said, "I believe it concerns Mrs. Vera Donovan. Will you hold Ms. Claiborne?" Then it clicked in. Greenbush, who sent her all the padded envelopes, registered mail. "Yeah," I says. "Pardon me," she says. "I'll hold," I says. "Thank you," she says back. There was a click, and I was left for a little while standing there in my underwear waiting. It wasn't long, but it seemed long. Just before he came on the line, it occurred to me that it must be about the times I'd signed Vera's name. They'd caught me. It seemed likely enough. Ain't you ever noticed how when one thing goes wrong, everything else seems to go wrong right behind it? Then he come on the line. "Ms. Claiborne," he says. "Yes, this is Dolores Claiborne," I told him. "The local law enforcement official on Little Tall Island called me yesterday afternoon and informed me that Vera Donovan had passed away," he said. "It was quite late when I received the call, and so I decided to wait until this morning to telephone you." I thought of telling him there was folks on the island not so particular about what time they called me, but of course I didn't. He cleared his throat and then said, "I had a letter from Mrs. Donovan 5 years ago, specifically instructing me to give you certain information concerning her estate within 24 hours of her passing." He cleared his throat again and said, "Although I have spoken to her on the phone frequently since then, that was the last actual letter I received from her." He had a dry, fussy kind of voice, the kind of voice that when it tells you something, you can't not hear it. "What are you talking about, man?" I asked. "Quit all this backing and filling and tell me." He says, "I'm pleased to inform you that aside from a small bequest to the New England Home for Little Wanderers, you are the sole beneficiary of Mrs. Donovan's will." My tongue stuck to the roof of my mouth, and all I could think of was how she'd caught on to the vacuum cleaner trick after a while. "You'll receive a confirming telegram later today," he says, "but I'm very glad to have spoken to you well before its arrival. Mrs. Donovan was very emphatic about her desires in this matter." "Yeah," I says. "She could be emphatic, all right. I'm sure you're grieved at Mrs. Donovan's passing. We all are. But I want you to know that you are going to be a very wealthy woman. And if I can do anything at all to assist you in your new circumstances, I would be as happy to do so as I was to assist Mrs. Donovan. Of course, I'll be calling to give you updates on the progress of the will through probate, but I really don't expect any problems or delays. In fact..." "Whoa on, chummy," I says. And it came out in a kind of croak. Sounded quite a bit like a frog in a dry pond. "How much money are you talking about?" Of course, I knew she was well off, Andy. The fact that in the last few years she didn't wear nothing but flannel nighties and lived on a steady diet of Campbell's soup and Gerber's baby food didn't change that. I saw the house, I saw the cars, and I sometimes looked at a wee bit more of the papers that came in those padded envelopes than just the signature line. Some were stock transfer forms, and I know that when you're selling 2,000 shares of Upjohn and buying 4,000 of Mississippi Valley Light and Power, you ain't exactly tottering down the road to the poorhouse. I want asking so I could start applying for credit cards and ordering things from the Sears catalog either. Don't go getting that idea. I had a better reason than that. I knew that the number of people who thought I'd murdered her would most likely go up with every dollar she left me, and I wanted to know how bad I was going to get hurt. I thought it might be as much as $60,000 or $70,000, although he had said she left some money to an orphanage, and I figured that'd take it down some. There was something else biting me, too, biting the way a June deerfly does when it settles on the back of your neck. Something way wrong about the whole proposition. I couldn't put my finger on it, though. No more than I'd been able to put my finger on exactly who Greenbush was when his secretary first said his name. He said something I couldn't quite make out. It sounded like blub-dub-gub area of $30 million. What did you say, sir? I asked. That after probate, legal fees, and a few other small deductions, the total should be in the area of $30 million. My hand on the telephone had started to feel the way it does when I wake up and realize I slept most of the night on it, numb through the middle and all tingly around the edges. My feet were tingling, too, and all at once the world felt like it was made of glass again. "I'm sorry," I says. I could hear my mouth talking perfectly well and perfectly clear, but I didn't seem to be attached to any of the words that were coming out of it. It was just flapping, like a shutter in a high wind. "The connection here isn't very good. I thought you said something with the word million in it." Then I laughed, just to show how silly I knew that was. But part of me must have thought it weren't silly at all, because that was the fakest sounding laugh I ever heard come out of me. "Yeah, yeah, yeah," it sounded like. "I did say million," he said. "In fact, I said 30 million. And do you know, I think he would have chuckled if it hadn't been Vera Donovan's dead body I was getting that money over. I think he was excited. That underneath that dry, prissy voice, he was excited as hell. I suppose he felt like John Beresford tipped him, the rich fella who used to give away $1 million at a crack on that old TV show. He wanted my business. Of course, that was part of it. I got a feeling that money's like electric trains to fellas like him, and he didn't want to see such an almighty big set as Vera's taken away from him. But I think most of the fun of it for him was just hearing me flub-dubbing around like I was doing. "I don't get it," I says, and now my voice was so weak I could hardly hear it myself. "I think I understand how you feel," he says. "It's a very large sum, and of course it will take a little getting used to." "How much is it, really?" I asked him. And that time he really did chuckle. If he'd been where I could have got to him, Andy, I believe I would have booted him in the seat of the pants. I really do. He told me again, $30 million. And I kept thinking that if my hand got any number, I was going to drop the phone. And I started to feel panicky. It was like someone was inside my head, swinging a steel cable around and around. I'd think $30 million. But those were just words. When I tried to see what they meant, the only picture I could make inside my head was like the ones in the Scrooge McDuck comic books Joe Jr. used to read Little Pete when Pete was 4 or 5. I saw a great big vault full of coins and bills, only instead of Scrooge McDuck paddling around in all that dough with the spats on his flippers and those little round spectacles perched on his beak, I'd see me doing it in my bedroom slippers. Then that picture'd slip away, and I'd think of how Sammy Marchant's eyes had looked when they moved from the rolling pin to me and then back to the rolling pin again. They looked like Selena's had looked that day in the garden, all dark and full of questions. Then I thought of the woman who called on the phone and said there were still decent Christians on the island who didn't have to live with murderers. I wondered what that woman and her friends were going to think when they found out Vera's death had left me $30 million to the good. And the thought of that came close to putting me into a panic. "You can't do it," I says, kind of wild. "You hear me? You can't make me take it." Then it was his turn to say he couldn't quite hear, that the connection must be loose someplace along the line. I ain't a bit surprised either. When a man like Greenbush hears someone saying they don't want a $30 million lump of cash, they figure the equipment must be frigged up. I opened my mouth to tell him again that he'd have to take it back, that he could give every cent of it to the New England Home for Little Wanderers, when I suddenly understood what was wrong with all this. It didn't just hit me. It come down on my head like a dropped load of bricks. "Donald and Helga," I says. I must have sounded like a TV game show contestant coming up with the right answer in the last second or two of the bonus round. "I beg pardon?" he asks, kind of cautious. "Her kids," I says. "Her son and her daughter. That money belongs to them, not me. They're kin. I ain't nothing but a jumped-up housekeeper." There was such a long pause then. that I felt sure we must have been disconnected. And I weren't a bit sorry. I felt faint, to tell you the truth. I was about to hang up when he says in this flat, funny voice, "You don't know." "Don't know what?" I shouted at him. "I know she's got a son named Donald and a daughter named Helga. I know they was too damn good to come and visit her up here, although she always kept space for 'em. But I guess they won't be too good to divide up a pile like the one you're talking about now that she's dead." "You don't know," he said again. And then, as if he was asking questions to himself instead of to me, he says, "Could you not know, after all the time you worked for her? Could you? Wouldn't Ken Apensky have told you?" And before I could get a word in edgewise, he started answering his own damn questions. "Of course it's possible. Except for a squib on an inside page of the local paper the day after, she kept the whole thing under wraps. You could do that 30 years ago if you were willing to pay for the privilege. I'm not sure there were even obituaries." He stopped, then says, like a man will when he's just discovering something new, something huge, about someone he's known all his life, "She talked about them as if they were alive, didn't she? All these years." "What are you globbering about?" I shouted at him. It felt like an elevator was going down in my stomach. And all at once, all sorts of things, little things, started fitting together in my mind. I didn't want them to, but it went on happening just the same. "Of course she talked about them like they were alive. They are alive. He's got a real estate company in Arizona, Golden West Associates. She designs dresses in San Francisco, Gaylord Fashions." Except she'd always read these big paperback historical novels with women in low-cut dresses kissing men without their shirts on, and the trade name for those books was Golden West. It said so on a little foil strip at the top of every one. And it all at once occurred to me that she'd been born in a little town called Gaylord, Missouri. I wanted to think it was something else, Galen or maybe Galesburg, but I knew it wasn't. Still, her daughter might have named her dress business after the town her mother'd been born in, or so I told myself. "Miss Claiborne," Greenbush says, talking in a low, sort of anxious voice, "Mrs. Donovan's husband was killed in an unfortunate accident when Donald was 15 and Helga was 13. "I know that," I says, like I wanted him to believe that if I knew that, I must know everything. And there was consequently a great deal of bad feeling between Mrs. Donovan and the children. I decided I'd known that, too. I remembered people remarking on how quiet the kids had been when they showed up on Memorial Day in 1961 for their usual summer on the island, and how several people had mentioned that you didn't ever seem to see the three of them together anymore, which was especially strange, considering Mr. Donovan's sudden death the year before. Usually something like that draws people closer, although I suppose city folks may be a little different about such things. And then I remembered something else. Something Jimmy DeWitt told me in the fall of that year. They had a wowser of an argument in a restaurant just after the 4th of July in 61, I says. The boy and girl left the next day. I remember the hunky, Ken Apensky, I mean, taking him across to the mainland in the big motor launch they had back then. "Yes," Greenbush said. "It so happens that I know from Ted Ken Apensky what that argument was about. Donald had gotten his driver's license that spring, and Mrs. Donovan had gotten him a car for his birthday. The girl, Helga, said she wanted a car, too. Vera, Mrs. Donovan, apparently tried to explain to the girl that the idea was silly. A car would be useless to her without a driver's license, and she couldn't get one of those until she was 15. Helga said that might be true in Maryland, but it wasn't the case in Maine, that she could get one there at 14, which she was. Could that have been true, Miss Claiborne, or was it just an adolescent fantasy?" It was true back then, I says, although I think you have to be at least 15 now. Mr. Greenbush, the car she got her boy for his birthday, was it a Corvette? Yes, he says, it was. How did you know that, Ms. Claiborne? I must have seen a picture of it sometime, I said. But I hardly heard my own voice. The voice I heard was Vera's. I'm tired of seeing him winch that Corvette out of the quarry in the moonlight, she told me as she lay dying on the stairs. Tired of seeing how the water ran out of the open window on the passenger side. I'm surprised she kept a picture of it around, Greenbush said. Donald and Helga Donovan died in that car, you see. It happened in October of 1961, almost a year to the day after their father died. It seemed the girl was driving. He went on talking, but I hardly heard him, Andy. I was too busy filling in the blanks for myself, and doing it so fast that I guess I must have known they were dead. Somewhere, way down deep, I must have known it all along. Greenbush said they'd been drinking and pushing that Corvette along at better than 100 miles an hour when the girl missed a turn and went into the quarry. He said both of them were probably dead long before that fancy two-seater sank to the bottom. He said it was an accident, too. But maybe I knew a little more about accidents than he did. Maybe Vera did, too. And maybe she'd always known that the argument they had that summer didn't have jack shit to do with whether or not Helga was going to get a state of Maine driver's license. That was just the handiest bone they had to pick. When McAuliffe asked me what Joe and I argued about before he got choking me, I told him it was money on top and booze underneath. The tops of people's arguments are mostly quite a lot different from what's on the bottom, I've noticed. And it could be that what they were really arguing about that summer was what had happened to Michael Donovan the year before. She and the hunky killed the man, Andy. She did everything but come out and tell me so. She never got caught either. But sometimes there's people inside of families who've got pieces of the jigsaw puzzle the law never sees. People like Selena, for instance. And maybe people like Donald and Helga Donovan, too. I wonder how they looked at her that summer, before they had that argument in the Harborside restaurant, and left Little Tall for the last time. I've tried and tried to remember how their eyes were when they looked at her. If they were like Selena's when she looked at me. And I just can't do it. Perhaps I will in time, but that ain't nothing I'm really looking forward to, if you catch my meaning. I do know that 16 was young for a little hellion like Don Donovan to have a driver's license. Too damn young. And when you add in that hot car, well, you've got a recipe for disaster. Vera was smart enough to know that, and she must have been scared sick. She might have hated the father, but she loved the son like life itself. I know she did. She gave it to him just the same, though. Tough as she was, she put that rocket in his pocket. And Helga's, too, as it turned out, when he wasn't but a junior in high school and probably just starting to shave. I think it was guilt, Andy. And maybe I want to think it was just that, because I don't like to think there was fear mixed in with it. That maybe a couple of rich kids like them could blackmail their mother for the things they wanted over the death of their father. I don't really think it. But it's possible, you know. It is possible. In a world where a man can spend months trying to take his own daughter to bed, I believe anything is possible. They're dead, I said to Greenbush. That's what you're telling me. Yes, he says. They've been dead 30 years and more, I says. Yes, he says again. And everything she told me about them, I says, it was a lie. He cleared his throat again. That man's one of the world's greatest throat-clearers, if my talk with him today's any example. And when he spoke up again, he sounded damn near human. What did she tell you about them, Ms. Claiborne? He asked. And when I thought about it, Andy, I realized she'd told me a hell of a lot. Starting in the summer of 62, when she showed up looking 10 years older and 20 pounds lighter than the year before. I remember her telling me that Donald and Helga might be spending August at the house, and for me to check and make sure we had enough Quaker rolled oats, which was all they'd eat for breakfast. I remember her coming back up in October. That was the fall when Kennedy and Khrushchev were deciding whether or not they was going to blow up the whole friggin' world, and telling me I'd be seeing a lot more of her in the future. "I hope you'll be seeing the kids, too," she'd said. But there was something in her voice, Andy, and in her eyes. Mostly it was her eyes I thought of as I stood there with the phone in my hand. She told me all sorts of things with her mouth over the years, about where they went to school, what they were doing, who they were seeing. Donald got married and had two kids, according to Vera. Helga got married and divorced. But I realized that ever since the summer of 1962, her eyes had been telling me just one thing, over and over again. They were dead. Yeah. But maybe not completely dead. Not as long as there was one scrawny, plain-faced housekeeper on an island off the coast of Maine who still believed they were alive. From there, my mind jumped forward to the summer of 1963, the summer I killed Joe, the summer of the eclipse. She'd been fascinated by the eclipse, but not just because it was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. No, sir. She was in love with it because she thought it was the thing that'd bring Donald and Helga back to Pinewood. She told me so again and again and again. And that thing in her eyes, the thing that knew they were dead, went away for a while in the spring and early summer of that year, Andy. You know what I think? I think that between March or April of 1963 and the middle of July, Vera Donovan was crazy. I think for those few months, she really did believe they were alive. She wiped the sight of that Corvette coming out of the quarry where it had fetched up from her memory. She believed them back to life by sheer force of will. Believed them back to life? No, that ain't quite right. She eclipsed them back to life. She went crazy, and I believe she wanted to stay crazy, maybe so she could have him back, maybe to punish herself, maybe both at the same time. But in the end, there was too much bedrock sanity in her, and she couldn't do it. In the last week or 10 days before the eclipse, it all started to break down. I remember that time when us who worked for her were getting ready for that Christless Eclipse expedition and the party to follow like it was yesterday. She'd been in a good mood all through June and early July, but around the time I sent my kids off, everything just went to hell. That was when Vera started acting like the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland, yelling at people if they so much as looked at her cross-eyed and firing house help left and right. I think that was when her last try at wishing them back to life fell apart. She knew they were dead then and ever after. But she went ahead with the party she'd planned just the same. Can you imagine the courage that took? The flat-out, coarse-grained, down-in-your-belly guts. I remembered something she said, too. This was after I'd stood up to her about firing the Jolanda girl. When Vera come up to me later, I thought sure she was going to fire me. Instead, she give me a bag full of eclipse watching stuff and made what was, to Vera Donovan at least, an apology. She said that sometimes a woman had to be a high-riding bitch. Sometimes, she told me, being a bitch is all a woman has to hold on to. Yeah, I thought. When there's nothing else left, there's that. There's always that. Miss Claiborne, a voice said in my ear, and that's when I remembered he was still on the line. I'd gone away from him completely. Miss Claiborne, are you still there? Still here, I says. He'd asked me what she told me about him, and that was all it took to set me off thinking about those sad old times. But I didn't see how I could tell him all that. Not some man from New York who didn't know nothing about how we live up here on Little Tall, how she lived up on Little Tall. Putting it another way, he knew an almighty lot about Upjohn and Mississippi Valley Light and Power, but not bugger all about the wires in the corners. Or the dust bunnies. He starts off, "I asked what she told you. She told me to keep their beds made up and plenty of Quaker rolled oats in the pantry," I says. "She said she wanted to be ready because they might decide to come back any time." And that was close enough to the truth of how it was, Andy. Close enough for Greenbush, anyway. "Why, that's amazing," he said. And it was like listening to some fancy doctor say, "Why, that's a brain tumor." We talked some more after that, but I don't have much idea what things we said. I think I told him again that I didn't want it, not so much as one red penny. And I know from the way he talked to me, kind and pleasant and sort of jollying me along, that when he talked to you, Andy, you must not have passed along any of the news flashes Sammy Marchant probably gave you and anyone else on Little Tall that had listened. I suppose you figured it wa'n't none of his business, at least not yet. I remember telling him to give it all to the Little Wanderers, and him saying he couldn't do that. He said I could, once the will had cleared through probate, although the biggest idiot in the world could have told he didn't think I'd do any such thing once I finally understood what had happened. But he couldn't do doodly squat with it. Finally, I promised I'd call him back when I felt a little clearer in my mind, as he put it, and then hung up. I just stood there for a long time. Must have been 15 minutes or more. I felt creepy. I felt like that money was all over me, stuck to me like bugs used to stick to the flypaper my dad hung in our outhouse every summer back when I was little. I felt afraid it'd just stick to me tighter and tighter once I started moving around, that it'd wrap me up until I didn't have no chance in hell of ever getting it off again. By the time I did start moving, I'd forgot all about coming down to the police station to see you, Andy. To tell the truth, I almost forgot to get dressed. In the end, I pulled on an old pair of jeans and a sweater, although the dress I'd meant to wear was laid out neat on the bed, and still is, unless somebody's broke in and took out on the dress what they would have liked to taken out on the person who belonged inside of it. I added my old galoshes and called it good. I skirted around the big white rock behind the shed and the blackberry tangle, stopping for a little bit to look into it and listen to the wind rattling in all those thorny branches. I could just see the white of the new concrete well cap. Looking at it made me feel shivery, like a person does when they're coming down with a bad cold or the flu. I took the shortcut across Russian Meadow and then walked down to where the lane ends at East Head. I stood there a little while, letting the ocean wind push back my hair and wash me clean like it always does, and then I went down the stairs. Oh, don't look so worried, Frank. The rope across the top of them and that warning sign are both still there. It's just that I weren't much worried about that set of rickety stairs after all I had to go through. I walked all the way down, switching back and forth, until I come to the rocks at the bottom. The old town dock, what the old-timers used to call Simmons Dock, was there, you know. But there's nothing left of it now but a few posts and two big iron rings pounded into the granite, all rusty and scaly. They looked like what I imagine the eye sockets in a dragon's skull would look like, if there really were such things. I fished off that dock with my sisters many a time, Andy, and I guess I thought it'd always be there, but in the end the sea takes everything. I sat on the bottom step, dangling my galoshes over, and there I stayed for the next 7 hours. I watched the tide go out, and I watched it come most of the way in again before I was done with the place. At first I tried to think about the money, but I couldn't get my mind around it. Maybe people who've had that much all their lives can, but I couldn't. Every time I tried, I just saw Sammy Marchant first looking at the rolling pin and then up at me. That's all the money meant to me then, Andy. And it's all it means to me now. Sammy Marchant looking up at me with that dark glare and saying, "I thought she couldn't walk. You always told me she couldn't walk, Dolores." Then I thought about Donald and Helga. Fool me once, shame on you. I says to no one at all, as I sat there with my feet dangling so close over the incomers that they sometimes got splattered with curds of foam. Fool me twice, shame on me. Except she never really fooled me. Her eyes never fooled me. I remembered waking up to the fact, one day in the late 60s this must have been, that I had never seen him, not even once, since I'd seen the hunky taking him back to the mainland that July day in 1961. And that so distressed me that I broke a long-standing rule of mine not to talk about him at all, ever, unless Vera spoke of him first. "How are the kids doing, Vera?" I asked her. The words jumped out of my mouth before I knew they were coming. With God's my witness, that's just what they did. How are they really doing? I remember she was sitting in the parlor at the time, knitting in the chair by the bow windows, and when I asked her that, she stopped what she was doing and looked up at me. The sun was strong that day. It struck across her face in a bright, hard stripe, and there was something so scary about the way she looked that for a second or two I came close to screaming. It wasn't until the urge had passed that I realized it was her eyes. They were deep-set eyes, black circles in that stripe of sun, where everything else was bright. They were like his eyes when he looked up at me from the bottom of the well, like little black stones or lumps of coal pushed into white dough. For that second or two, it was like seeing a ghost. And she moved her head a little, and it was just Vera again, sitting there looking like she'd had too much to drink the night before. It wouldn't have been the first time if she had. "I don't really know, Dolores," she said. "We are estranged." That was all she said, and it was all she needed to say. All the stories she told me about their lives, made-up stories I know now, didn't say as much as those three words, "We are estranged." A lot of the time I spent today down by Simmons Dock, I spent thinking about what an awful word that is. Estranged. Just the sound of it makes me shiver. I sat there and picked over those old bones one last time, and then I put them aside and got up from where I'd spent most of the day. I decided that I didn't much care what you or anyone else believed. It's all over, you see. For Joe, for Vera, for Michael Donovan, for Donald and Helga, and for Dolores Claiborne, too, one way or another. All the bridges between that time and this one have been burned. Time's a reach, too, you know, just like the one that lies between the islands and the mainland. But the only ferry that can cross it is memory, and that's like a ghost ship. If you want it to disappear, after a while it will. But all that aside, it's still funny how things turned out, ain't it? I remember what went through my mind as I got up and turned back to them rickety stairs. The same thing that went through it when Joe snaked his arm out of the well and almost pulled me in with him. I have digged a pit for mine enemies and am fallen into it myself. It seemed to me as I laid hold of that old splintery banister and got set to climb back up all those stairs, always assuming they'd hold me a second time, of course, that it had finally happened and that I'd always known it would. It just took me a while longer to fall into mine than it took Joe to fall into his. Vera had a pit to fall into, too. And if I've got anything to be grateful for, it's that I haven't had to dream my children back to life like she did. Although sometimes when I'm talking to Selena on the phone and hear her slur her words, I wonder if there's any escape for any of us from the pain and the sorrow of our lives. I couldn't fool her, Andy. Shame on me. Still, I'll take what I can and grit my teeth so it looks like a grin, just as I always have. I try to keep in mind that two of my three children live still, that they are successful beyond what anyone on Little Tall would have expected when they were babies, and successful beyond what they maybe could have been if their no good of a father hadn't had himself an accident on the afternoon of July 20th, 1963. Life ain't an either-or proposition, you see. And if I ever forget to be thankful my girl and one of my boys lived while Vera's boy and girl died, I'll have to explain the sin of ingratitude when I get before the throne of the Almighty. I don't want to do that. I got enough on my conscience, and probably on my soul, too, already. But listen to me, all three of you, and hear this if you don't hear nothing else. Everything I did for love. The love a natural mother feels for her children. That's the strongest love there is in the world, and it's the deadliest. There's no bitch on earth like a mother frightened for her kids. I thought of my dream as I reached the top of the steps again and stood on the landing just inside that guard rope, looking out to the sea. The dream of how Vera kept handing me plates and I kept dropping them. I thought of the sound the rock made when it struck him in the face and how the two sounds were the same sound. But mostly I thought about Vera and me, two bitches living on a little chunk of rock off the main coast, living together most of the time in the last years. I thought about how them two bitches slept together when the older one was scared, and how they passed the years in that big house, two bitches who ended up spending most of their time bitching at each other. I thought of how she'd fool me, and how I'd go and fool her right back, and how happy each of us was when we won a round. I thought about how she was when the dust bunnies ganged up on her, how she'd scream and how she trembled like an animal that's been backed into a corner by a bigger creature that means to tear it to pieces. I remember how I'd climb into the bed with her and put my arms around her and feel her trembling that way, like a delicate glass that someone's tapped with the handle of a knife. I'd feel her tears on my neck, and I'd brush her thin, dry hair and say, "Shh, dear, shh. Those pesky dust bunnies are all gone. You're safe, safe with me." But if I found out anything, Andy, it's that they ain't never gone, not really. You think you're shut of them, that you dusted them all away and there ain't a dust bunny any place, and then they come back. They look like faces. They always look like faces. And the faces they look like are always the ones you never wanted to see again, awake or in your dreams. I thought of her laying there on the stairs, too, and saying she was tired, she wanted to be done. And as I stood there on that rickety landing in my wet galoshes, I knew well enough why I'd chosen to be on those stairs that are so rotted not even the hellions will play on them after school lets out or on the days when they play hooky. I was tired, too. I've lived my life as best I could by my own lights. I never shirked a job nor cried off from the things I had to do, even when those things were terrible. Vera was right when she said that sometimes a woman has to be a bitch to survive. But being a bitch is hard work. I'll tell the world it is. And I was so tired. I wanted to have done. And it occurred to me that it wasn't too late to go back down those stairs, and that I didn't have to stop at the bottom this time either, not if I didn't want to. Then I heard her again, Vera. I heard her like I did that night beside the well. Not just in my head, but my ear. It was a lot spookier this time, I can tell you. Back in 63, she'd at least been alive. "What can you be thinking about, Dolores?" she asked in that haughty kiss my back cheeks voice of hers. "I paid a higher price than you did. I paid a higher price than anyone will ever know. But I lived with the bargain I made just the same. I did more than that. When the dust bunnies and the dreams of what could have been were all I had left, I took the dreams and made them my own. The dust bunnies? Well, they might have gotten me in the end, but I lived with them for a lot of years before they did. Now, you've got a bunch of your own to deal with, but if you've lost the guts you had on the day when you told me that firing the Jolanda girl was a boogery thing to do, go on. Go on and jump. Because without your guts, Dolores Claiborne, you're just another stupid old woman." I drew back and looked around, but there was only East Head, dark and wet with that spray that travels in the air on windy days. There wasn't a soul in sight. I stood there a while longer, looking at the way the clouds ran across the sky. I like to watch them. They're so high and free and silent as they go their courses up there. And then I turned away and started back home. I had to stop and rest two or three times on the way because that long time sitting in the damp air at the bottom of the steps put an awful misery in my back. But I made it. When I got back to the house, I took three aspirin, got into my car, and drove straight here. And that's it. Nancy, I see you've piled up pretty near a dozen of those little tiny tapes, and your cunning little recorder must be just about wore out. So am I. But I came here to have my say, and I've had it. Every goddamn word of it, and every word is true. You do what you need to do to me, Andy. I've done my part, and I feel at peace with myself. That's all that matters, I guess. That, and knowing exactly who you are. I know who I am. Dolores Claiborne, 2 months shy of my 66th birthday. Registered Democrat. Lifelong resident of Little Tall Island. I guess I want to say two more things, Nancy, before you hit the stop button on that rig of yours. In the end, it's the bitches of the world who abide. And as for the dust bunnies, frig ya. Scrapbook. From the Ellsworth American, November 6, 1992. Page 1. Island Woman Cleared. Dolores Claiborne of Little Tall Island, longtime companion of Mrs. Vera Donovan, also of Little Tall, was absolved of any blame in the death of Mrs. Donovan at a special coroner's inquest held in Machias yesterday. The purpose of the inquest was to determine if Mrs. Donovan had suffered wrongful death, meaning death as the result of neglect or criminal act. Speculation concerning Miss Claiborne's role in the death of her employer was fueled by the fact that Mrs. Donovan, who was reputedly senile at the time of her death, left her companion and housekeeper the bulk of her estate. Some sources estimate the worth of the estate to be in excess of $10 million. From the Boston Globe, November 20th, 1992, page 1. A happy Thanksgiving in Somerville. Anonymous benefactor gives $30 million to orphanage. The stunned directors of the New England Home for Little Wanderers announced at a hastily called press conference late this afternoon that Christmas is coming a little early for the 150-year-old orphanage this year, thanks to a $30 million bequest from an anonymous donor. We received word of this amazing donation from Alan Greenbush, a reputable New York attorney and certified public accountant, said a visibly flustered Brandon Jager, head of the NEHLW's board of directors. It appears to be completely on the level, but the person behind this contribution, the guardian angel behind it, I should perhaps say, is completely serious about his or her anonymity. It almost goes without saying that all of us associated with the home are overjoyed. If the multi-million-dollar donation proves out, the Little Wanderer's windfall would be the largest single charitable contribution to a single Massachusetts institution. From the Weekly Tide, December 14th, 1992, page 16. Notes from Little Tall by Nosy Nettie. Mrs. Lottie McCandless won the Christmas coverall at Friday Night Beano in Jonesport last week. The prize totaled $240, and that's a lot of Christmas presents. Nosy Nettie is so jealous. Seriously, congratulations, Lottie. John Karen's brother, Philo, came down from Derry to help John caulk his boat, the Deep Star, while it was at dry dock. There is nothing like a little brotherly love in this blessed season, is there, boys? Jolene Aubuchon, who lives with her granddaughter Patricia, finished a 2,000-piece jigsaw puzzle of Mount St. Helens last Thursday. Jolene says that she's going to celebrate her 90th birthday next year by doing a 5,000-piece puzzle of the Sistine Chapel. Hurrah, Jolene! Nosy Nettie and all at the Tide like your style. Dolores Claiborne will be shopping for one extra this week. She knew her son Joe, Mr. Democrat, was coming home from his toils in Augusta for an island Christmas, but now she says that her daughter, Famous magazine scribe Selina St. George will be making her first visit in over 20 years. Dolores says she feels very blessed. When Nosy asked if they would be discussing Selina's latest think piece in the Atlantic Monthly, Dolores would only smile and say, "We'll find lots to talk about, I'm sure." From the early recovery department, Nosy hears that Vincent Bragg, who broke his arm playing football last night.
This has been a presentation of Penguin Highbridge Audio.